We think it will affect all of the appropriated fund employees on the installation with very few exceptions. So somewhere just over 2,000 employees will be affected.
The commander at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson braces for sequestration cuts. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, fighting over funding of early education in rural Alaska.
You're talking about some pretty remote places here that don't have cash economies, don't have a tax base to ask their taxpayers for more money to fund these programs.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. has upheld the listing of polar bears as threatened. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
The polar bear was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in 2008. Because the appeals court upheld that ruling, no laws change. Alaska Attorney General Mike Garrity says it's too early for the state to decide what options it has. He says that the polar bear population is healthy, and this ruling sets a precedent that it's legal to preemptively list a species as threatened.
The polar bear is based on a 45-year projection. I mean, nobody disputes that the current species has a healthy population. It takes a certain amount of speculation to figure out what's going to happen 45 years from now with climate change. And also, what about the adaptability of the species to loss of habitat?
The polar bear's plight is so clear and so dire, there was really never any serious question that they deserved protection under the Endangered Species Act.
Cassie Siegel is an attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity. Her group was one of the appellees in the suit. Siegel says the polar bear is the first species to be placed on the endangered list solely because of climate change. And now that the court has ruled, she says climate policy needs to follow.
The science on climate change and the very real threats that the polar bear faces have long been indisputable. They are now also legally indisputable as well. But what we really need to do now is to get serious about swift greenhouse pollution cuts, because that's what we need to do to save polar bears.
Siegel says it's only a matter of time for Fish and Wildlife to upgrade the polar bear's status from threatened to endangered, but that's another case entirely. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Congress has failed to come up with a deal, so across-the-board sequester cuts take effect at midnight. But what that may ultimately mean is still a moving target. The commander at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, Colonel Brian Duffy, says he would like to be hopeful that Congress will still find a solution before the late-night deadline.
But should it be put in place, we've been advised we should see some reductions in our operations and maintenance funding lines, which are the funding lines we use to operate most of the services on the installation. And then, of course, we've all heard that if this goes through, there may be the potential for administrative furlough for a significant portion of our civilian workforce.
What exactly would that mean? Is it a day a week? How many people would it impact?
You bet. The furlough, we've received guidance to suggest the furlough would be about 176 total hours and may begin around the late part of April and then last through the rest of the fiscal year through the end of September. What that will translate to, we think, in the majority of the workforce is a reduction of 8 hours per week, 16 hours per pay period. And so we're still working through the details on how that will lay in for every civilian employee. If and when this is a formal action that we're asked to administer, there will be formal notification provided to each employee, an opportunity for them to provide us some feedback, and then a final decision will be made.
Is it difficult to know at this point in time how many people that may be?
We think it will affect, all of the appropriated fund employees on the installation with very few exceptions. So somewhere just over 2,000 employees, will be affected.
Will these sorts of impacts, furloughs and other money-saving attempts, impact only civilian personnel, or will they be broader than that?
Well, certainly it'll be most visible in the effect we see on our civilian personnel if and when the administrative furlough is put in place. But other reductions in funding that supports base infrastructure repair, other services and programs we have on the installation may not be as dramatically visible early in the game and may be seen a little bit later down the line.
And what about movement of personnel to and from the Middle East conflicts? What would sequester cuts mean for that area?
Yeah, right now the president has exempted military personnel moving, normal moving, and military personnel expenditures from the sequester effects. But we will still operate support for contingency operations to include Enduring Freedom and others around the world in a manner similar to what you see now.
How difficult does this uncertainty make for forward planning for you?
I tell you, it does make it difficult, but we're doing our best to try to, one, keep the leadership here informed based on guidance we're getting from our hire, but then also ensuring that our base population is informed as possible. And so we've been very active in using as many media outlets as we've got on the installation to provide reference to Office of Personnel Management websites for additional information on administrative furlough. We've been very open and frank with our mission partners as the Air Force, based on what they're receiving from DOD, has asked that we slow spending in a number of areas, and some of which we've already announced, cutting back on facility sustainment projects, cutting back on funding expenditures that are projected to be going beyond the fiscal year 13 boundary, and ensuring that TDY travel, if you will, are for only those absolute most critical of requirements.
Colonel Brian Duffy is the commander for JBAIR and the 673rd Air Base Wing. Communities are bracing for the automatic sequestration cuts, as KSKA's Daisha Eaton tells us plans are already underway in Anchorage.
Officials with the municipality expect sequestration to impact the People Mover bus system. Lance Wilbur, the director of public transportation for the municipality of Anchorage, says that's because his department's budget is heavily supported by federal grants.
Roughly 20% of our operating budget is supported through operating dollars from the federal government. And we use those funds to really keep our system on route. On the capital side, it's more significant. Roughly 70 to 80% of our capital improvements is supported 70 to 80% by the Federal Transit Administration.
Wilbur says sequestration could slow down bus and bus stop improvements, as well as customer service upgrades. According to officials at the Anchorage Police Department, grants that support DWI and seatbelt patrols could be reduced, as well as those that provide funding to fight internet crimes against children and support task forces on human trafficking and illegal drugs. Anticipated sequestration reductions for the 2013-2014 Anchorage School District budget equal about $6 million and were included in recent budget cuts. Chad Steitler, ASD budget director, says the district is watching Department of Defense reductions at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson closely because they could impact the district down the road.
As the federal footprint in Alaska is reduced, we expect that that will also reduce the population and the enrollment inside of the district. And so we've considered that along with the actual immediate financial impacts of the sequestration.
The district gets a little less than 10% of their funding from federal monies. Most sequestration cuts would probably take time to trickle down to the local level until the end of 2013 or the beginning of 2014. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A subcommittee in the state legislature is looking to shave money from early education programs. The group tasked with looking at education in the House rolled out their recommendations last night and has proposed trimming $6 million from Governor Sean Parnell's budget. A pre-kindergarten pilot program and two programs focused on teaching parents how to educate young children all saw reductions. Representative Tammy Wilson, a Fairbanks Republican, chairs the subcommittee. She says part of the reason she made the cuts was because she doesn't want the state to commit to paying for new programs in the face of declining oil revenue. She also believes that some of the state's early education programs could be competing with private daycare.
Should we also be competing with the ones that are completely private? By starting new daycares and new preschool using state funding while other parents are having to pay for it. And I think that's where the discussion needs to be.
Wilson has targeted the early education programs for cuts in past years and attempted to cut the pre-K pilot program's $2 million budget entirely. The pilot program was created in 2009 and is in about a dozen schools, mostly in remote districts. Studies by the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development have shown growth in vocabulary from participating students. Representative Harriet Drummond, an Anchorage Democrat, opposes the cuts. She says that spending on early education now will save the state money down the road. Drummond also questions the idea that these early education programs are competing with the private sector.
How's that going to happen? I mean, you're talking about some pretty remote places here that don't have cash income, cash economies, don't have a tax base to ask their taxpayers for more money to fund these programs. I don't know where this funding is supposed to come from.
The subcommittee's recommendations will now be reviewed by House Finance. If accepted, the subcommittee's recommendations would cut almost a fifth of the early education funding that had been included in the governor's budget. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Iditarod rookie gets ready to race.
I just was like, wow, that looks really cool. I think I want to do that someday. And they're like, oh my God, do you have any idea what that takes and what you're talking about? And I didn't.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give, or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
A group of North Slope villagers filed suit yesterday in federal court against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. According to Brian Littmans with the law firm Trustees for Alaska, seven residents of New Ixit claim that the Corps violated the Clean Water Act in issuing a permit to ConocoPhillips to fill nearly 60 acres of wetlands for the oil company's Colville Delta 5 project. Littman says the Corps' permit allows ConocoPhillips to build several bridges and a six-mile road through prime hunting and fishing grounds used by New Ixit residents.
Plaintiffs in this case are very concerned about this project as it's proposed because it goes through very sensitive habitat in the Colville River Delta, so they have challenged this decision because the Corps failed to consider all of the impacts associated with this project.
Littman says that the Corps originally denied the oil project because of concerns about the impacts to the Delta, but the agency reversed its decision in late 2011, allowing ConocoPhillips to proceed. The project calls for a 1,400-foot bridge across the Nicklick Channel, an area of rich subsistence fish harvests. The suit alleges that the Corps violated the Clean Water Act because the agency did not explain why it decided to reverse its original decision and violated the National Environmental Policy Act by failing to consider recent information about the effects of development on the Colville River Delta. Corps spokesman Kurt Bieberdorf says the Corps is not commenting on the suit. The Alaska Federation of Natives has changed its bylaws to give tribes more votes during conventions. The move separates tribal votes from tribal corporation votes. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes reports.
The new bylaw amendment gives tribes their own class of membership. In the past, tribes were registered along with village corporations, so tribes and village corporations often shared membership dues and split convention votes. Now, voting includes four categories: regional corporations, the regional nonprofit Native associations, village corporations, and tribes. It will give tribes in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta hundreds more votes, 516 more to be exact. Board member Anna Hoffman is a village representative from the Chulista AVCP region.
It does increase the village impact of the vote at the AFN convention. So the village and tribal presence really has increased a lot.
AFN's 36-member board of directors accepted the proposed change at their meeting last month. Another change they made broadens the AFN board composition to include tribal members. In the past, each region had three board members, one from its regional corporation, one from its regional nonprofit, and one from its village corporations. Now, the village corporation seat is a village representative seat and is open to all eligible tribal members as well as village corporations. These changes will affect the next AFN convention, which is scheduled for October in Fairbanks. Another bylaw change adopted by the AFN board ratifies the co-chair system of leadership, which has been in place for many years. The next AFN board meeting will be held May 9th in Kotzebue. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
A state superior court decision could sidetrack state administration plans to change water protection statutes. Earlier this week, the court decided in favor of the Chewitna Citizens Coalition in a case involving what is termed in-stream flow rights to Middle Creek on the west side of Cook Inlet. The coalition filed for in-stream flow rights in 2009, saying that wild salmon populations in the creek need to be protected. But the State Department of Natural Resources failed to process the application. Later, DNR approved a temporary water use permit for Packrim Coal to remove water from the same creek, with the coalition application pending. So the coalition appealed to the courts. The court has decided that DNR failed to follow its own rules. Ron Burnett is a member of the coalition. He says in-stream rights mandate a certain amount of water has to remain in the creek.
Well, what it means to us is now we have at least recognition that our court system believes that there should be water remaining in that stream year-round to let salmon spawn and rear there. But right now, it gives us the right that we have water that's going to stay in these spawning streams.
Burnett says 22% of the Chewitna River salmon spawn in Middle Creek. But DNR's Division of Mining, Land, and Water Operations Chief Wynne Menefee says the decision only mixes up two different kinds of water use regulations.
The decision did not necessarily focus on how an in-stream flow reservation is created or how we evaluate that, but it was more about what do we have to evaluate in order to issue the temporary water use authorization.
Menefee says temporary water use permits are revocable at any time and have a separate set of regulations than do other types of water rights. He says DNR has not decided how to respond just yet.
We have 10 days to file a reconsideration or move toward appeal, and we're considering our options at this point.
The decision highlights the rights of citizens to challenge decisions on water use that could collide head-on with companion bills Governor Sean Parnell has introduced to the House and Senate, HB 77 and SB 26, which would allow only state agencies to file applications for in-stream flow and would remove citizens' rights to appeal state agency decisions on some resource matters. In a press release today, Representative Les Guerra urged lawmakers to support an amendment to HB 77. Which would prohibit the administration from granting general permits for taking water from fish-producing streams in amounts that would harm fish populations.
Alaska News Nightly.
Wells Fargo extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK and Alaska News Nightly. I'm Alex DeWeer. This week on AK, Rookie. 13 rookies will hit the trail this weekend for the 1,000-mile Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. They're an international bunch hailing from Norway, Russia, and even Brazil. 8 call Alaska home, including musher Christy Roloffs, who keeps 22 dogs in a barn in her backyard in East Anchorage. Roloffs is a pediatric dentist who fell in love with the idea of racing the Iditarod when she moved to Alaska more than a decade ago. APRN's Annie Fite has this story.
Christine Roloffs gives all of her dogs middle names. There's Inca June, Raver Franklin, and Curtis Jackson. It adds some authority when she wants their attention.
Spike their mommy loves you or mommy's really mad at you name.
Right now, it's all love. And Roloffs is focused on a big brown dog named Venger Joseph. She's struggling to get large booties on his outsized feet.
Venger, look at those paws. He has feet. These would be what I call size 16s. Like an NBA player. Look at those big paws. Holy camoly. Attaboy.
Roloffs is getting 16 dogs ready for one of the team's last training runs before the Iditarod. After all 64 booties are on, it's time for harnesses.
Come here, big guy. Come here. Raver, do you want to be a good leader today? Come here, put your foot in here. Come on, sweetie.
There's probably no musher more excited to hit the Iditarod Trail this year. Roloffs has spent 6 long years preparing for the moment, slowly building a kennel of dogs and gaining experience as a musher. When she moved to Alaska in 1999 from Kentucky, she didn't even know what the Iditarod was. A friend took her to the starting line in 2000.
And I just was like, wow, that looks really cool. I think I want to do that someday. And they're like, oh my God, do you have any idea what that takes and what you're talking about? And I didn't. I had no idea.
But she wasn't swayed.
You know, just watching the dogs work together as a team and watching the mushers run the sleds, I think that's what drew my attention first, is like, wow, to have that many dogs doing everything together.
So in 2006, she bought a big dog barn and had it moved to her yard in East Anchorage. She bred 2 litters of puppies and bought some from other mushers like Dee Dee Johnro and Martin Boozer, all while building a solo practice in pediatric dentistry, a job she's had to work part-time this year to train for the Iditarod. Only if pushed will Roloffs admit she doesn't get much sleep, but it's easy to get her talking about her dogs. She says keeping a kennel in the middle of the city has worked surprisingly well.
My team is a very well-socialized bunch of lovers that love to lick and kiss and hug and jump on you, although we work on our behavior in the city. And they stay pretty quiet in the city. They kind of understand they're not allowed to just bark like crazy in Anchorage, but when we go out to Willow, or like when I drop them here from the truck in a minute, they will go crazy. And that's okay. We'll let them bark as much as they want when they're not in there. Home, but they figured that out pretty fast, and we have great neighbors that let us, that don't mind too much when there's a little noise at feeding time, or, you know, the errant moose comes through the yard, and boy, they let you know there's a moose in the yard.
Roloffs has finished 3 300-mile races and completed 450 miles of the Yukon Quest in 2011. During that race, she was forced to withdraw. She says she didn't carry enough dog food on a long and challenging stretch of trail. That forced her to accept help from race officials, which disqualified her. Roloff says it was a tough experience, but she learned a lot.
And do you feel ready for the Iditarod?
I don't know. Is that like asking somebody if they're ready to have a baby? I don't know if you ever feel like you're really ready, but my friends that have done it before think that I'll do okay. I just want to take the best care of the dogs and make sure that I don't make any gross errors that would cause any problems out there. But I just have to draw on everybody else's experience saying your dogs are ready, you're going to be fine. And that's the best I can hope for.
With booties and harnesses on, Roloffs is now hooking up her dogs to the tow line.
Sorry, come here, sweetie. Come here, my little sweet sevens. There you go. I know, you're a good boy.
It's taken at least 45 minutes to get the team ready for this one run. Multiply that over hundreds of runs over the last several years and add in dog care and driving time. Roloff says given the enormous commitment, this may be her only Iditarod.
Iditarod's huge. I don't know if anybody can really appreciate, you have to give up everything else to be able to get to the starting line of this race.
With the last dog attached to the line, the team starts barking like crazy. But as soon as Roloff steps on the sled and takes up the brake, they're quiet, intent on pulling their musher down the trail. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Now it's time for 300 Villagers. This week, we're heading to the northern part of Alaska's panhandle, Haines. The community of over 1,800 people is a gateway between the U.S. and Canada.
My name is Dan Henry, and I'm from Haines, Alaska. Lived there for 30 years. Plan on being a resident for many more years. Haines is a small town with its own attitude and doesn't like to be overwhelmed anyway. So people have a good time with the folks who come by, and we get just the right numbers. We're not a Disneyland. There's a lot of outdoor activity as well, and certainly my family and I have spent time out kayaking and hiking and snowshoeing and skiing. I have friends who go parasailing. There's a lot of helicopter skiing, heli-skiing around the area. What do people do for a living? Right now, I'd say that they do a variety of things, services, a lot of visitor sorts of things, small businesses, telecommuting, fishing certainly is a part of that, small logging outfits. You know, there's a little bit of everything, but not too much of one thing. So we've changed over the years. 40s and 50s and 60s, Haines had two mills working 24/7. Lumber mills, and it was a logging town. And then in the late 60s, it became known, and the early 70s, it became known that there was also the world's largest congregation of bald eagles, the Chilkat River Flats. And so as the timber resources declined, going the way of the Tongass in the 70s and early 80s, the recreation resources increased. All that is great about Alaska is in Haines. I think that's one of the unique parts. Looking for a small town, all of the amenities and a very thriving arts community and a museum and a wonderful library and a lot of real cultural activities, Haines is great for that. And if you're looking for relationships and friendships and people who are open and interesting and very unique and independent, then Haines is that.
Daniel Lee Henry is a longtime community member in Haines. 300 Villages is AKA's attempt to put every community in Alaska on radio. Thanks for listening to AKA this week. We had help from Dave Waldron and Annie Fite. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Alex Stewart.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. At our site, you can see a GoPro video of Christine Roloff's training run. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. Alex DeWare was our AKA guest host this week. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Parents, be a hero to your kids. Make time to be physically active as a family. Encourage your children to participate in the Alaska Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. All kids need to do is be active 3 times a week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes, too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.